Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
Hello, Sound Opinions listeners. It's Jim DeRogatis, and you are listening to a special bonus podcast. I'm doing this one without Greg Kot because I have a level of expertise on the story that really is only matched by one other journalist and cultural critic, Kathy Iandoli, who has just written a book, Baby Girl, better known as Aaliyah. We are going to dive deep into the sad, inspiring, timeless story of this singer who released three brilliant albums in her lifetime, died at the age of 22. In a minute on Sound Opinions. Sound Opinions is supported by Goose Island. Since 1988, Goose Island has been brewing award-winning beers in Chicago that are inspired by this city. Take 312 Lemonade Shandy, Tropical Beer Hug Double IPA, and a rotating series of hazy IPAs only available in Chicago. Every time we go down to Goose Island, there's another one that they're pushing on us.
That's right.
All good.
Absolutely. And what supporters of musical culture, in the city of Chicago and elsewhere, if you go to a show in Chicago and you see that Goose Island sign, you know you're in good hands. They're music fans as well as great beer makers at Goose Island, so we're really proud to be associated with them.
The Goose Island Beer Company, Chicago's beer.
Sound Opinions is supported by Goose Island. Since 1988, Goose Island's been brewing beers in the spirit of Chicago.
You can find IPAs, Lemonade Shandy, and limited releases in-store or at one of Goose's venues in Chicago. Goose Island Beer Company, Chicago's beer. I'm back. It's Jim DeRogatis. We are going to talk about Aaliyah. Let me issue a trigger warning here. The following conversation contains a discussion of sexual abuse of a minor. Please take care of yourself. If that is going to be disturbing, we won't be offended if you cannot listen. But do know that most of the conversation, until fairly late in our chat, is about the genius of Aaliyah's music. We are doing this special bonus podcast because of several historic firsts last week. For the first time in a federal courtroom on August 18th, the name Aaliyah was spoken as one of Kelly's victims, that he had underage sexual contact with her while writing the album he called Age Ain't Nothing But a Number. The next day, we heard the first witness tell that story for the first time. It's a story I'd reported in 2000. It is now very much in the news. All of that happened a day before. After a 20-year drought, Aaliyah's music finally began appearing on streaming sites. And there is this brilliant new book, Baby Girl, better known as Aaliyah. That's a lot of context, Kathy Iandoli, but I wanted listeners to know why we're doing it this way. Baby Girl, better known as Aaliyah, you write crystal clear. This is a book by an Aaliyah fan for the Aaliyah fans. Let's start with the musical legacy of this young woman, when you became a fan, and what you think the appeal is to so many.
I became a fan arguably on the first day that Aaliyah became a part of music for us. You know, I was watching MTV when the Back and Forth video premiered.
It's Friday and I'm ready to swing. Pick up my girls and hit the party scene tonight. Oh, it's all right. So get up.
So I was watching in real time this dynamic superstar on the rise, just like right in front of me, and we were the same age. So
you were 15?
Yeah.
Like she was?
We were born a month apart. And I'm watching this girl just, and you know, Aaliyah looked and sounded like no other artist that was out during that time frame. I mean, you remember what was going on during that time period where it was...
Yeah, we're talking 1994.
Yeah, where it became, everyone had to look alike, and you have groups that all dressed the same, and you know, there was something very... It was a very just, you know, dressed monochromatically, and everything just looked like it was paired, and there was no difference, right? Like, there was no diversity. And then you have Aaliyah. And I remember just seeing her and thinking to myself, wow, like, who is this? She's so cool. But, you know, the other things kind of got in the way during the, you know, inching into 95. And then she returns with One in a Million in 96. And
yeah.
That, there were maybe some fragments of the style from Back and Forth, the Back and Forth video, or even just, you know, obviously the other songs.
Well, her mentor and producer had called that look the R&B thug. Okay.
Yes.
So a little bit of street hip hop wear, but then always something else.
Mm-hmm.
This glamour.
Yes. I think the thing that was missing when you got to One in a Million, as opposed to AJ Nothing But a Number, the stylistically what was missing wasn't needed. It was kind of like you were, you know, you kind of chipped away at the unnecessary parts, and this now you got Aaliyah, right?
Yeah.
And
yeah,
once you got
her.
Yeah, once you got her in full form, then it was like, oh my goodness. Like, she's dynamic.
Your love is a one in a million. It goes on and on and on. You can't give it all day long.
Well, now, One in a Million, 1996, not only says this woman is a serious artist who's going to have a long career. She is nobody's ingenue. It makes her career, establishes her as a serious artist. It also makes the career, pretty much they had done a few things before, but Timbaland and Missy Elliott. What did you learn about that unique team that made that record?
Well, the one thing that I don't think we actually realized with One in a Million was how disjointed the project was in theory, because it is actually two parts. The first part was kind of haphazardly like piecing together a bunch of producers because nobody wanted to work with Aaliyah after the R. Kelly situation for fear that they wouldn't get to work with R. Kelly again, right?
Right.
So you had this handful of tracks where there were so many, I don't want to call them brave, but you had these brave producers and collaborators who were kind of just working with her for this chunk of the project. And which included, like, you know, Jermaine Dupri, Dark Child. Like, there were
some serious producers.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
But again, not wanting to be the whole of the project, right?
Right.
Throwing her a track here and there. And then you have the other half that is like Aaliyah. And that's the Timbaland Missy combination. And I think the chemistry. And I don't know what the conversations were surrounding why they realized what this bond really was. When you think about where Missy and Timbaland came from with the Swing Mob, they had their own trauma, right?
Yeah.
You know? And
Missy as a woman, as a woman in hip hop, never had an easy path.
Never.
And to this day, I don't think she gets the credit Timbaland ever got.
No, absolutely. And so they kind of bravely left this, you know, tumultuous situation too with Swing Mob. Aaliyah leaves R. Kelly's side. The uncertainty alone of where the fates of their careers were going to be, like, in this moment, that's like hanging overhead. So they kind of all come together, and it's just like throwing the caution to the wind. What can we do? Like, we might as well push the envelope. We might as well take these risks. You know, it's in those risks that you're ultimately setting the tone for what a trend will be 5-10 years from now, which is why obviously Aaliyah's music is so relevant now, because of the risks they took. Yeah, it's the risk they took 25 years ago, right? So I think that there was, you know, this kind of misfits, right, who came together.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, yeah.
And found each other.
Yeah. All right. So you may take issue with me, and that's fine. You know, we're both from Jersey, right?
Yes.
We can take it. I would say Aaliyah never had the greatest, most powerful, stunning voice. She was not a Beyonce, right? She was a good singer, no doubt about it. But there was always something more. And you hear it on One in a Million coming into its own. There was something more. There was a relatability, a way she spoke to the listener's soul. Would you agree with me? I mean, I don't know if, you know, I'm not crediting her producers. Where she went in her career was on her talent. But it wasn't just the singing.
It wasn't. But when you think about how hard it is for a falsetto to keep that range while you're dancing on a stage...
Yeah.
It's very easy to write off the quality of her voice, because it's even hard to be a balladeer with a falsetto, you know? And also Aaliyah warmed up singing opera. So I struggle to see an opera singer doing a dance routine while they're, you know, belting.
No, you're right. I mean, you know, she called her aunt. They weren't blood, but, you know, performing as a little tyke, you know, a preteen with Gladys Knight. Auntie Gladys Knight, you know, and Gladys is like blown away. But Gladys herself said there was something, there was a charisma above and beyond the talent as a dancer, as a singer.
Absolutely. And I think what it was that what Aaliyah exuded on the inside was an artist, was a musician, you know, who could do so many different things, which ultimately made her this perfect package, if you think about it, right? Because there are some artists, not Beyonce, like you mentioned, I mean, Beyonce is a perfect package as well, but there are some artists who are all voice and may not have the other stuff, right? And then there's some artists who struggle with voice but may have just like something very specific outside of that. Aaliyah had enough of everything and more and then some. So it's the personality and the swag and the charisma and the confidence, and I think the determination. Like, I think she was just very aware of the fact that she had to put her best self forward, because if she didn't, there was so much at stake. We had this other conversation that was like overhead, right? Even now.
The dark cloud. Especially now.
Yes. So she had to continuously defy the odds. And the only way you do that is through consistency, authenticity, heart, passion, determination. Because really, let's think about it. With all that she endured in 94, the criticism and the backlash that she got from that in 95, some people might have just quit.
Yeah.
You could tell she really wanted to be there. She wanted to be there.
Yeah. And she had something to prove. You write, that woman was made of steel.
Yes.
And that's saying something for a tough chick from Jersey.
Yeah.
What do you mean by that?
I mean that you have to be a certain type of individual, a certain type of woman, to endure what you endure at a young age, to consistently maybe understand that you are the nucleus that is making all of this happen, yet still being seen as an accessory, an ingenue, to your point.
A prop.
You have to be a certain type of individual who still gets out on that stage, who still just boldly continues to push the envelopes of fashion and music, acting, going into these worlds when you know the conversations that people are still having about you.
Yeah.
And succeeding. And we never, ever, ever gave Aaliyah enough credit for that, because inside she was made of steel, but on the outside she was just so sweet and kind. It's the street but sweet. You know, it's that whole, that descriptor.
Also, you know, having interviewed her once and only once when the debut album came out, that combination of naivete and this is one, you know, because she's so young, 15, and you could tell at times she's a 15-year-old girl the way she laughed, right? Mm-hmm. And then every once in a while, these nuggets that your 97-year-old grandmother would have passed on as pure wisdom. It's, and you'd be like, wow, this is an old soul in such a young woman's body.
Mm-hmm. She was definitely an old soul there. And I think because how we're seeing her legacy live on even 20 years later, you know that she was otherworldly. She wasn't of this planet. She didn't look like, people can replicate the Aaliyah look, but Aaliyah was Aaliyah, and Aaliyah will always be Aaliyah.
Remind listeners, Kathy, what the name Aaliyah means in Arabic.
It means the highest, most exalted one, the best, or the champion, like Muhammad Ali. You know, it's a feminized version of Ali.
The Aaliyah album, self-titled. All right, whenever an artist, well-established in their career, self-titles an album, it's always something of a declaration. I'm rebooting. I'm doing something else. 2001 comes out, spawns several more hits, as record companies are wont to be. They are greedy to wring one more out of it. She's making a video. She just finished a video in the Bahamas, and she's killed. August 2001, 22, in a plane crash, small plane. Let's talk about the music. What did that album accomplish?
You know, first of all, she didn't really have her One in a Million team with her. You know, at this at this point, they were kind of estranged. And Static Major, who is a genius in his own right, he kind of stepped forward to help take the reins of this project. And the project had to be recorded in Australia, while she's filming Queen of the Damned. She's doing all these things. You're talking about a 5-year time frame between One in a Million and the Aaliyah project, right?
Yeah, 96 to 2001. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And yeah, she had Try Again, Are You That Somebody. She had a couple of like soundtrack hits sprinkled in, but you're talking about 5 years in between albums. And
yeah, forever in pop music time.
Oh gosh, yeah. So they all go, this whole team, and they head out to Australia, and there's a difference in the studio time now, right? Aaliyah's not being handed a reference track that she then adds her own lyrics to in a freestyle way when she's re-singing it like she did on One in a Million. Static's kind of sitting with her and being like, so, talk to me about your relationship that had gone sour. And Aaliyah talks about it, and he's writing the lyrics. And she's like, let's change it to that. It was very collaborative. When Aaliyah was going into the songwriting portion of it, Static saying, no, push yourself, keep going, you know?
Yeah.
When she's in the booth, no, push those vocals, like, keep going. You have it. And I think that was an entirely different experience from what Aaliyah might have been used to in any project, but also just as an adult who was really just really coming into her own and realizing her her power and recognizing her identity. So yeah, you call it Aaliyah because it feels the most like an Aaliyah project, right?
Yeah, and she had contributed more directly to it with some of the lyrics she added than the earlier records.
Yeah, and it wasn't just her changing things up as she got in the booth. It was her sitting and making these songs collaboratively, which is entirely different.
Right. Right. Why did she fall out? You mentioned quickly she fell out with the One in a Million team. Why? I mean, I always thought that Timbaland and Missy just got so busy, everybody wanted a piece of them. They were now bona fide hit makers. But what was the falling out there?
Well, it was Ginuwine who actually kind of confirmed it publicly that there had mm-hmm. been something going on. And you know, in speaking with people for the book, the story that I have been told is, I think it was more regarding Blackground than Aaliyah herself.
Yeah, but that's the record company that her uncle, Barry Hankerson, ran.
Yes. And because, you know, you're talking about Aaliyah, who I found from the, after her passing, you found that she was a 10% owner in the whole company, right? So now mm-hmm. it's like, it becomes a family business. And when that family business is not paying its employees, you're blaming all the bosses, right?
Yeah.
So...
Yeah.
You know, there was like kind of this separation, and I think there was, you know, this pressure where if every project Aaliyah had a different team mm-hmm. and that wasn't you being like how Madonna would reinvent herself with each project. Like if there's no continuity, if your team always changes. So by the third one, it might look like it's a you problem, right? And, yeah. and Aaliyah was urged to then, she had to be the one to go to Timbaland and ask for some tracks. Mm-hmm. So we need a resolution is a song based on an argument. I'm tired of arguing, girl.
Baby, let me know.
Give me bits and pieces. You trying to blame me when I don't even know the reason. I think it's just the season. Maybe the month, maybe the feeling.
Timbaland never puts himself as the person talking to her. Like, even in Are You That Somebody, he's saying baby girl, better known as Aaliyah. He's kind of hyping her.
Yeah.
But that song is the two of them singing to each other.
Yeah.
You know, did you sleep on the wrong side of the bed? Like, you know, and him being like, you give me bits and pieces. You know, you try to play me when I don't even know the reason. They're arguing with each other.
Well, later this afternoon, Thursday, August 19th, R. Kelly's road manager, one of his best friends, came up with him from the streets of the South Side, is going to take the stand in Kelly's racketeering trial in New York. Demetrius mm-hmm. Smith, he first spoke to me in 2000. And began to tell me what happened with Aaliyah. He bought fake documents on Maxwell Street in Chicago saying she was 18. That enabled a wedding. Kelly was 27. She was 15. Out at one of the airport hotels here by O'Hare. As soon as her family found out about it, they were separated. They never spoke again. I reported all this. You cite my reporting. You know, there were documents that had been sealed by the courts in Michigan and Illinois because she was still living in Detroit. I've seen those documents. I've written about those documents. All right. There was this marriage. The world finds out about it, and the whole thing is sort of covered up. Was she really 15? Was she 18? I mean, I had the Jive Records press releases saying she was 15. Other people were saying, I don't know. I asked her about it. People say all sorts of things. Don't believe that mess, she tells me, as she told any journalist who dared to ask her about Kelly. We now know there was a settlement, $100 officially, possibly $3 million or more, off the books, my sources told me. As a journalist and as a fan, you know, like all great music writers, you are balancing both. I think it's safe to say neither you nor I know 100% what happened there. You don't claim to. You report the evidence that's been on the record and the evidence you've dug up through your reporting. That's all I ever did as well. And some of it remains a mystery. But what does it mean to her fans and to you that for the first time in federal court, people are going to hear that this young woman was wronged at 15 by the dominant voice in R&B?
I say finally. That's
yeah.
This is a long time coming. And I have to say something though, Jim. You know, if it wasn't for your reporting and your diligence and your willingness to protect these girls, you were literally the only journalist who did, and I took a page from your playbook when I wrote chapters 2 and 3. Because you The thing from reading Soulless and reading all of your reporting is facts over feelings, right? All you can do is lay out the facts. That's all you can do. Because, when I read the stuff that you had found and then the other stuff that I dug up, and I was sick to my stomach thinking how arguably the media, fans, we misdiagnosed this disease, you know? And even for these trials, she was Jane Doe number one, and now, she is listed as a victim, but for the first time, she can be listed as a survivor.
Right, right. The only thing I would correct you on there, Kathy, is I was persistent. I'm thick-headed. But it was those women. It was those women, including many who loved Aaliyah, including some who shared stages with Aaliyah, who were brave enough to speak to me.
Oh, yeah.
That enabled this story to get out. Without those women, this trial and the one that will follow in Chicago would not be happening. So everything is all the credit to the women. But if she had come out in her lifetime, we still don't know. Your book doesn't come to a conclusion. Mine doesn't either.
Right.
Why did she never speak on the record about the wrong done to her? Why did her mother never speak on that? Barry Hankerson is R. Kelly's manager. He is Aaliyah's manager. He runs her record company. His sister works in his office, right? Aaliyah's mom. Nobody in the Hankerson or Houghton families have ever spoken on the record about what the hell happened with that illegal marriage, that illegal sexual contact in when she was 15. We don't know if they're going to testify in trial. We don't know what evidence about Jane Doe number one Aaliyah is going to be presented. We do know that just a couple of weeks ago, for the first time, I researched Barry Hankerson extensively. For the first time, he gave a long video interview to Billboard talking about how the Kelly situation and the death of Aaliyah drove a wedge between him and his sister, Aaliyah's mom, and that was at the root of why, for 20 years, you couldn't stream any Aaliyah's music. All of these things, her name being said in court, Hankerson talking for the first time on the record to the music trades, these have to be connected, no?
I think so. I think, first of all, I think let's be very clear, and I have my book in front of me, which I cite from your book, right? And I want to read something really quickly. The passage, the wording from the sealed document that you say.
Yeah.
It says that the agreement, R. Kelly was to pay $100 or $3 million to Aaliyah in exchange for cutting ties altogether. Due to the nature of the music industry and its ability to engender rumors and disseminate both true and untrue as per the agreement. And then that they're not supposed to speak on any of this, and R. Kelly is not held accountable even if a decline in her ability, reputation, or marketability, emotional distress caused by any aspect of her business or personal relationship with Robert, or physical injury or emotional pain and suffering from any assault or battery perpetrated by Robert against her person. So
I will confess, I missed, when I first had that document, I missed assault and battery. He hit her. I had not heard about him, according to that document, right?
Yes.
I had not heard about him hitting any young woman when I started that reporting. And now we've had dozens who've spoken bravely on the record. Did he hit Aaliyah the way he has hit some of these other women? It's a horrifying question.
Well, you wouldn't
didn't
put it
hurt her physically.
You wouldn't put in a document that he was protected from hurting her physically if he didn't hurt her physically. And
yeah.
Due to
a document sealed by the court that I was never supposed to see.
Right. And if you think about the wording from a legal standpoint,
yeah,
it almost in a roundabout way prevents Aaliyah from even getting therapy. Because when they talk about the decline in her ability to perform, HIPAA aside, you then can't get the healing that you're supposed to have. Like, you're not able to recover. So the recovery there was a price tag on that. And, that will stop people from speaking. But I think, you mentioned something about Barry Hankerson and all of this, you know, the music coming to light, you know, finally tomorrow being the start of this very staggered rollout, right? I think that the reason why he finally is speaking is because, and not speaking on that, speaking on just speaking in general and then talking about just like putting this music out. I think Barry is just very well aware of the fact that in many ways he's been villainized this whole time, right?
He has, yeah.
And if I will say, when I finished writing this book, I didn't have as much animosity towards Barry Hankerson. I wasn't mad at him, because anybody, and you talk about this too, who when Barry put two and two together when he was watching Tia Hawkins talk on trial, finally clicked that he's like, if it could happen to her, it could happen to my niece. And he cut ties with R. Kelly at that point.
They walked away from millions of dollars.
Walked away from millions of dollars, and in that farewell suggests that he gets help. And then... Yeah.
Puts that on the record.
Yes.
He only spoke to me a few times on the record. He puts me on the phone with his attorney, who tells me about the letter he wrote to Kelly's people, including Jive Records, and says this man has a compulsion for illegal sexual pursuit, and he needs help.
And then, because Barry is a gangster as much as he is a music industry mogul.
I was hoping you would point that out. There is something a little frightening about Mr. Hankerson.
But then he tries to have him killed, R. Kelly.
He goes to Louis Farrakhan and says, "Minister, I'm going to kill that man."
And, you know, Minister,
which is on the record, on video.
On the record. And Minister Farrakhan says he's a man of God. Let us take these videos for you. Let's take these off your hands. Let's get them in another way. But I think, like, there was too much comfort in making Barry look like the villain. And because of a contract and I don't care how much it is, it's still just a couple of dollars. You can't villainize Barry Hankerson and not villainize R. Kelly. You know, the one thing that Barry said in the video that really hit me was, he was like, "I hope the fans can forgive me." Because we know that Barry didn't want to hold on to this music for that long. And I think, you know, after, you know, I believe he suffered a stroke, you know, he's the man, he's the only, if God forbid something happened to him, her music could never get out.
Right.
So I think he had to pull this lever, because I think he watched his niece's legacy completely just being kind of dismantled. Because if you look at like the way that Aaliyah is treated now without music, you know how like when you go into different churches and Jesus looks different to fit the comfort of the congregation?
Yeah.
That's who Aaliyah's become. She's become this piece of iconography that you pick up and you play, and it fits the comfort of the fan. You know, I've seen, there are so many doctored photos of Aaliyah. Ones where she's wearing a Muslim hijab in some, you know, sometimes her skin is lighter than in others. They darken her skin. They change her body proportions. Like, she's become the statue that just fits whatever the person who is experiencing Aaliyah for the first time sans music. Right. Because because those of us who experienced her in between the years of 1994 and 2001, we're not going to doctor a photo of Aaliyah. I mean, sometimes I put my cover of the book in her hand, but let's just, you know, get that.
That's just a little Photoshop.
Just, you know, being cute. But no, but when I'm not distorting Aaliyah's person. I'm not changing her from who she is. And when I was putting this book together, and you know, after the at least the announcement of it, and people started to just... Of course they pulled the wrong stuff out of the book. You know, you're talking about someone whose career was bookended by two catastrophes, right? So it became like just easy. And the whole point was not what was bookending it. The whole point of the whole book was the middle, right? Was the dash, so to speak, right?
The woman of steel.
Yes.
And this music. Yes.
So it was uncomfortable for people to understand finally that she was a human being. That was where it became uncomfortable, because now it was, you know, this you're giving my statue a heartbeat, you know?
Or you're saying the statue's a little off.
Yes.
Kathy, you and I have talked about this, but for the benefit of our listeners, there is this phenomenal thing. Now, I'm in Chicago. She's from Detroit, okay? But still, Chicago is the epicenter of the Aaliyah myth. I go to the Jewels, as we call it, the shopping mall. And there is a trans woman and checks me out at the cashier, and she's got the Aaliyah shirt. And her name is Aaliyah. And I've had three or four students at Columbia College Chicago who have been named Aaliyah. I have the guy at the UPS store where I get all my mail. Number one Aaliyah fan. He's just getting the tattoo this week to mark this historic week. Okay. Young Latinx boy. You know, the love. I've seen a lot. And I've seen my share talking about another death in the same time period, more or less. You know, Kurt Cobain t-shirts. Yes. I've seen them, right? And they come up to me and they, you interviewed Kurt, right? And I get that same, you interviewed Aaliyah, right? as if I, you know, the disciple touched the hem of the skirt of Jesus, right? And wow, that intensity. And again, to remind people, I'm talking 20 somethings who couldn't even listen to the music.
Yes.
Unless they found the used CDs for the last 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
Where does that come from?
It comes from this magnificent aura that we didn't appreciate when we had her around. We didn't get it. Like you could look at her and say, "Oh, I wanted her to be my best friend," which is something that I always said, right? You could look at her and just be like, "Oh, wow, you know, she's amazing. She's this. She's that." But because there was no other Aaliyah ever again, when you have this fan base who finds her, and the other thing is, they have to work hard to get her, right? They have to.
Yeah, they got
to
dig. They got to dig for that music.
They have to work overtime at their jobs to pay $300 for her vinyl, you know?
Yeah.
Or $56 on Amazon for her CD. I mean, now, you know, with Blackground releasing the catalog, it's different.
Right.
But for all of these fans, they had to work overtime. They had to go and, you know, I've spoken to so many fans, and you're talking about kids who, as their only Christmas present, just want an issue of Teen People that she was in. Or, you know, the YM magazine that, you know, one of my favorites. But they will be like, okay, you know what? Forget everything else. $35 on eBay. That's what I want for my birthday. That, like, these are the things, and they put together these phenomenal collections. Yeah. So when you work that hard to get to acquire all of this, it only adds to the love that you have for who or what you're collecting, right?
Yeah.
And that's the thing. Like, you're talking about in not only Aaliyah fans, but Aaliyah enthusiasts. You know, so and because the interviews are almost like watching reality TV for them, right? So so it's like watching a series, this thing that's happening and continues to happen, because now you have photographers coming forward and releasing like never before released photos, like Hamish Brown, who did the cover of my book. You know, we collaborated on him rolling out some unreleased photos. So you have all this stuff that's happening. And all of these fans are just like, yes, yes, yes. And if Aaliyah were still here, we probably wouldn't get outtakes of photo shoots. We wouldn't get grainy reference tracks. We wouldn't get any of those things. Because she would still be an active artist. So they're getting they're getting everything that you could possibly sweep up from the cutting room floor. And they're paying for it. They're digging for it. So it adds more meaning for them than arguably it did for us, because we had her here, but I think we took for granted just how long she would be here.
Well, okay, a place to end this. She is Jane Doe number one in the federal trial in New York. They couldn't keep that name secret, the name Aaliyah is being spoken in court. Do you think she's not victim number one? Several of the young women who became her backing singers were victimized, and then Kelly moved on to Aaliyah. She is arguably survivor number one in the biggest, most dramatic way. Two brilliant albums that follow after she is sexually abused by Kelly at age 15, a movie career launched. Who knows where she could have been had she not died at 22 in 2001. Do you think what I hope will happen, that other young women suffering trauma and abuse in their own lives, possibly in their own families, will look at her and take strength from the woman made of steel? Do you think now that this is all coming out, she will be an icon for an even better reason, more powerful reason?
Yes, and I hope that it will lead to young women putting their foot down in situations, like if they see a rickety plane, saying, yeah, I'm not getting on that, and being able to cite, Aaliyah didn't want to get on that, right? Like, yeah, or yeah, I'm uncomfortable flying to my 30-year-old producer's home to record an album. I need people with me. Mm-hmm. Or having people around maybe recognizing this doesn't look right. Because instead of using the catch-all, well, you remember when Aaliyah was messing with R. Kelly? No, that's not what happened. Yeah. You know,
when Aaliyah was assaulted by R.
Exactly.
Kelly.
Exactly. And I hope that with this trial and with my book, and I hope that people will once again revisit Soulless, I want us to just close this chapter. Like, this is, it's done now. Yeah. Let's stop dignifying that situation with a mention of his name. Like, let's get him, like, it, yeah, it's done, yeah, now. It's done now. There's 20 more years to honor her and 20 more after that. And after that, that we have to catch up on the flowers. You know, when they say the, when someone deserves their flowers, we have a lot of flowers to give Aaliyah, mostly with apology notes attached to them.
Well said. Kathy Iandoli, Baby Girl, better known as Aaliyah. It's the definitive biography of Aaliyah, a book that is as inspiring as it is sad at parts, you know, but one that needed to be written. So thank you for writing it, Kathy.
No, thank you for having me.
And thank you for coming on Sound Opinions.
Thanks. I appreciate it. I always love coming on here.
You've been listening to a bonus podcast of Sound Opinions, very timely, given the news about Aaliyah this week. We appreciate your support. We appreciate your listening. You can contact us on our Facebook group. You can join our Patreon. Until next time, thanks. And